What I would like to do tonight is go through chapter 6 and 7 in the book of Micah. And for those of you who haven't even been here, we've gone through the book of Micah. Micah was a prophet who prophesied around 750 B.C., around 800 B.C., around that period of time. He prophesied like during the reign of Hezekiah. He was a prophet that was like the contemporary of Isaiah. As far as I'm concerned, everything he said back then, thousands of years ago, could be applied to today. It's so crystal clear in my mind, because everything that he predicted or he foretold about the destruction of Israel or the moral and spiritual condition of Israel during his day, and why God was going to chastise them and really deal with them, you can see it in America today. And I'm telling you, everything that's happened to Israel because of their backsliding, because of their, you know, turning their back on God and getting into all kinds of idolatry and false religions and false worship. I mean, we see this in America. I mean, it's so abundantly clear. And America, keeping something in mind, America claims to be a Christian nation. That's why when you read the Bible, everything that applied to Israel, you can make the same application to America. Like, you couldn't make the application, for example, everything that Micah is saying in regards to, let's say, Cambodia or Laos or China or North Korea or South, you know, all of these other countries, I mean, hundreds of other countries do not claim to be Christian. This is one of the few nations on earth that does. So keep something in mind. Peter says the judgment begins in the house of the Lord, and I do believe when things really get bad, the United States is going to be one of the first countries to really be chastised severely, simply because God always deals with his own people first, and then he branches out and deals with all the other nations that are in disbelief or disobedience to his word. Okay, I'll tell you what, start with chapter 6, verse 1. It says, "Hear now what the Lord is saying. Arise and plead your case before the mountains, and let the hills hear your voice, and listen, you mountains, to the indictment of the Lord, you enduring foundations of the earth, because the Lord has a case against his people, even with Israel he will dispute." The first two verses, it is kind of ambiguous exactly who is doing the talking, whether it's Micah, whether it's the Lord, or whether it's Israel. And this, I read six or seven different translations, and it's not really concrete in my own mind exactly who's doing the speaking, but it doesn't matter, because regardless of who is, the message is still the same. And what God is basically saying is this. I believe what God is saying to Micah is, speak to the hills, speak to the mountains, speak to the enduring foundations. Tell them that God has a case against his people. And in a sense, you can almost see that what God is saying is, okay, my people will not listen to me. I've sent prophet after prophet after prophet after prophet after prophet to warn them, to tell them to change from their wicked ways, otherwise destruction is going to come upon them. Since they won't listen, then I want you, Micah, to speak to the mountains and the hills and the enduring foundations. And in speaking to them, they're going to be a witness against these people. And not only a witness, Micah, in a sense, is speaking to nature. And God is going to use nature as a means to chastise his people. You know, even though we're a couple of years, 3 years into the new millennium almost, the 1990s were referred to as the decade of disaster, right? I mean, there were so many destructive, I mean, really horrendous destructive hurricanes and tornadoes and earthquakes and forest fires and droughts, and the list goes on and on and on as far as the natural disasters that God had brought upon this country as well as the whole world to try to get people's attention, to try to get them to turn. Like I said, this world, this nation is on a collision course with an all-consuming fire, and it's almost as though God is saying through nature, warning, warning, warning. You're on the wrong track. You're going to collide with my justice. And when you do, it's not going to be pretty. So get, you know, yourself right. So, I mean, well, Micah's dealing with these people. He's dealing with their religious leaders and their political leaders and the people themselves when he's talking about the case that God has against his people. He says, look at it, verse 3. "My people, what have I done to you, and how have I wearied you? Answer me. Indeed, I brought you up from the land of Egypt. I ransomed you from the house of slavery. I set before you Moses, Aaron, and Miriam." In other words, God's asking a rhetorical question. Basically, Why have you turned away from me? What have I done to really weary you? You got tired of me. In a way, this is exactly what's happened in this country. I mean, people don't have any zeal, any enthusiasm for the things of God. And when I say people, I mean I'm including 90% of the church, and the self-professing church. And I was mentioning last week when we did go through this, it's like you got to picture the world as being like John Bunyan's Vanity Fair. We're all going through this world is like a carnival, where the devil's got 100,000 different sirens beckoning for our attention, you know, and you've got people over here trying to get your attention to go and three shots for a nickel here, do this over here. They got the brides here, this is the whole carnival, all the noise and the music, and it's all distraction. And we have to walk through this world with Christ, but I think the more you are in tune to Christ, the more you develop a love relationship with Christ, then all this other stuff you can enjoy, but you got your focus on Him. It's like if you're deeply in love with another person, it's like it's not what you're doing that's important. It's who you're with that makes all the difference in the world. But the problem with so many Christians today is they've lost sight of Christ and they've wandered away from Him and they've gotten so involved in the things of the world, this carnival, this never-ending circus that they've become so enthralled with. There's nothing wrong with using the world as long as you understand that, hey, this is all temporary. It's all going up in smoke. So when God asks, how have I wearied you? Well, this is how people get tired of God. They get tired of God because they don't feed upon God's Word. They don't drink deeply from communion with Him. They would rather read books that don't feed their soul or, programs and TV and entertainment. I mean, all of these things are legitimate. It's just simply when these things in the world become more important, it's going to be a natural consequence that they're weary of God and the things of God. So when he says, how have I wearied you? There's really no excuse because he's been there all the time. He's been blessing them, watching over them, protecting them, just like he's done to this nation. But listen, this nation has gotten so weary with God, and now we turn around and we blaspheme them day and night. All you have to do is look at our entertainment industry, look at Hollywood, look at the media, look at the judges, look at the lawyers, everywhere you turn, look at our schools, everywhere. You see, not only just that people have gotten weary of God, they've become downright hostile towards God and towards His people. He says, indeed, I brought you up from the land of Egypt. I ransomed you from the house of slavery. He says that indeed, I brought you up. Okay? It's almost as though the people had gotten to the point where God has to say indeed, I get the impression that people began to maybe even wonder if God did it in that miraculous way that it was written down in the book of Moses. Well, God could easily say to us today, indeed, I did create the world. I did create the universe. I did create you, and I did create every living thing and every stray atom in this universe. It didn't just evolve out of nothing. All right? It's almost as though God has to say, indeed, I did create. Indeed, there was Adam and Eve. Indeed. Right? Because why? Once people begin to speculate and come up with these hypotheses and to come up with all these different cockamamie ideas of how we all got here and how life began, then everything is thrown as a suspect as far as our relationship with God is concerned, or even if He even exists is concerned. See what I'm saying? So these people needed to have that reinforced to them. And it says, I ransomed you from the house of slavery. I set before you Moses, Aaron, and Miriam. In other words, look at today. We got false teachers, false prophets, false Christ. We've got all of these phonies coming out of the woodwork claiming to have the answer, claiming to have the truth, okay, professing a different gospel. I mean, they're coming from every angle. But even in spite of all the false teaching, all the false religions, all the cults and all everything that's going on, there's still very strong leadership that God has given us in today, even in the midst of all of this. I mean, He's given us people like Billy Graham or James Dobson or, Chuck Swindoll or Chuck Smith or, the late Mother Teresa or a number of women. He's still given us some very sound leadership. You can see it. All you have to do is listen to some of these Christian radio programs or going to a Bible bookstore and look at the number of authors that are out there that are still preaching the truth. They're still there. So there's really no excuse. People are just being selective as to who they want to be their teacher. This person is telling me the truth, but I don't want to hear the truth. This person is telling me what I know. This person is going to tickle my ear, so I'm going to go listen to him. Okay, this is where we're at today, right? Well, he says, my people remember now. Okay, he tells them, he says to them, remember. And I've looked up in concordance the number of times the words remember occurs. I mean, it's literally hundreds of times. It's almost as God has kind of constantly got to beat it into our head as far as, hey, you've got to recall these things. This is why God told his people back in the Old Testament. He says, hey, you need to speak of my word and my laws and my statutes and my ordinances. You need to speak to them, to your kids, day and night. You know, you need to pray with them. When you put them to sleep at night, you need to talk about God's word. You need to constantly reinforce it to them, you know, because we are so prone to forgetfulness. It's so easy for us to forget, isn't it? Forget the thing. That's why we need a constant, never-ending and continuous... come on, you guys. Get in here. You know, you be out there and you're falling asleep. Get in. Yeah. Hey, get out and give me 25 push-ups, man, for being so late. Okay. He says in verse 5, he says, my people, remember now what Balak, king of Moab, counseled, and what Balaam, son of Beor, answered him from Shittim to Gilead, in order that you may know the righteous acts of the Lord. And in other words, he wants them to remember a time in their history when God really stood up for them and protected them when it was a situation when the king of Moab, Balak, he was the king Balak from Moab, he saw these people coming across the desert, you know, all these hundreds of thousands of people, and he said, my God, where'd this mob come from? He says, man, these people are encroaching upon my territory. He says, I got to get rid of these people. And so he sent to Balaam, who was a prophet of God. He was a Gentile prophet of God. He sent to him and said, hey, get over here and curse these people, man. I'll make you a rich man. Well, Balaam, you know, he really wanted the money. He wanted the wealth. He wanted the prestige. He wanted the, you know, to be able to curse these people, even though he was a prophet of God. And God made it abundantly clear, no, you are not going to curse these people because I have blessed these people and you're not going to curse them. Balaam, man, he wanted the money so bad, he went to Balak and said, look, I can't curse these people because God told me I can't do it. But if you give me the money, I'll tell you a way which they can curse themselves. If you get them involved with the Moabite women and get them involved in the immoral practices, then they'll get involved in idolatry, and then God will lower the boom on them himself. Okay? Well, look at this country, right? From our inception, there have been people who have wanted this country to just go up in the smoke, right? And let's face it, if this country were hit with a nuclear blast, hey, there would be a multitude of people and a lot of nations throughout the world who would just stand up and cheer. Look how many cheered when 9/11 happened. Imagine what would happen if we got hit with some nuclear or atomic bombs, or atomic weapons. You know, this country is very, very hated. And yet, you know, God has protected this country from... And he has blessed this country. No other country on earth has been blessed like us. I mean, look at the abundant freedoms that we have, the abundant natural resources, the technology, everything that we have. So many people in the rest of the world would just be absolutely astounded if they even could imagine what it'd be like to live in America. But even though the rest of the world hasn't been able to curse us like they've wanted us to do it, we're bringing the curse on ourselves. God had made it abundantly clear through the writings of Deuteronomy that, hey, look, cursed are you if you don't follow me, if you don't obey me, if you don't live up to my statutes, then you are cursed. You're going to be cursed when you go in, you're going to be cursed when you get out, you're going to be cursed in the city, you're going to be cursed in the country, you're going to be cursed in your family, you're going to be cursed everywhere. There's going to be a curse if you don't obey me. Well, look at this country. We are so cursed. But it's not God that's cursing us. We brought the curse on ourselves, right? So he's saying, remember that I refused to curse you. I was just going to bless you. And he said, from Shittim to Gilead, in order that you might know the righteous acts of the Lord. In other words, from Shittim was on this side of the Jordan and Gilead was on the other side. In other words, from their very beginning, when they got into their new country, God blessed them from beginning to end. Okay, that's why he wanted them to remember that. And then he says in verse 6, he says, with what shall I come to the Lord and bow myself before the God on high? Shall I come to him with burnt offerings, with yearling calves? Does the Lord take delight in thousands of rams and 10,000 rivers of oil? Shall I present my firstborn for my rebellious acts, the fruit of my body for the sin of my soul? He has told you, O man, what is good, and what does the Lord require of you but to do justice and love kindness, or literally mercy, and to walk humbly with your God. So, in other words, if you read verses 6 and 7, what's implied there is, in spite of all of the people's wickedness, they were still, quote-unquote, very religious. They went to their synagogues. They went to the temple. They offered sacrifices. But what's the key ingredient that's lacking? You can sum it up in one word, basically, and that's obedience. Is this nation obeying God? Is the church as a whole obeying God? Because that's the key. Jesus made it abundantly clear, I think it was in John chapter 14, I believe. He said that these people who over here who obey me, they love me. These people over here who say that they love me, but they don't obey me, they don't love me. It all comes down to obedience. And then he says, what's really required? He says in that verse 8, he has told you, O man, what is good. In other words, hey, this isn't a mystery. This isn't some secret ceremony that is brought out in some secret ritual. He says, I've told you what's good. He says, what's good? And he says, what is required of you? To do justice. Well, look at this country. Look at it. They're talking about justice, injustice. Talk about making a complete mockery of justice in the courts. I mean, these lawyers, they are literally going to have a hell to pay on Judgment Day. They are so arrogant. They are so contemptuous when it comes to the truth. And then he says love kindness, literally to love mercy. In other words, what I'm talking about here is to love mercy. When another person wrongs you personally, I don't care if it's your spouse, I don't care if it's your classmate, if it's your sibling, your friend, your whoever wrongs you personally, then if you take the initiative to show mercy and forgive that person, then what you've done is what Jesus referred to, forgive us our trespasses as we forgive those who trespass against us. You're showing that kind of mercy. I mean, how many divorces today could be eliminated or could have been avoided if there was that kind of mercy? Okay, I'm just using that as a tiny example of when God says to love mercy, to love kindness. That's what he wants us to do, is to forgive one another, to show kindness towards one another in that respect. You know, but it's not up to me to forgive somebody who does something wrong to another person. It's not up to me. I mean, that has to be between the parties that are involved, to love mercy in terms of when people have offended you or hurt you personally. And it says, and to walk humbly with your Lord your God. I mean, that's it in a nutshell. Walk humbly with the Lord your God. In other words, if you, I always said, if you take Proverbs chapter 3, trust in the Lord with all your heart, don't rely upon your own understanding, in all your ways acknowledge him, he will direct your path. That to me, in a nutshell, describes what it is to walk humbly with God. Now I'm going to repeat this. Trust in the Lord with all your heart. Don't rely upon your own understanding. In all your ways acknowledge him, and he will direct your path. You see what I'm saying? That's it in a nutshell, what it means to walk humbly with God. He will direct your path. You're walking with him. Why? Because you're consulting him about everything. Right? And everything. Then he says here in verse 9, says, the voice of the Lord will call to the city, and it is sound wisdom to fear thy name. Hear, O tribe, who has appointed his time. Is there yet a man in a wicked house, along with the treasures of wickedness and a short measure that is cursed? Can I justify wicked scales and a bag of deceitful weights? For the rich men of the city are full of violence, and the residents speak lies, and their tongue is deceitful in their mouths. So also I will make you sick, striking you down, desolating you because of your sins, and you will eat, but you will not be satisfied, and your violence will be in your midst, and you will try to remove for safekeeping, and you will not preserve anything, and what you do preserve I will give to the sword. Okay, before we go on, he's just basically describing the moral character of the people, and basically he's summing them up as being liars and cheaters and deceivers. What they would do is they would use one set of measurements to buy their product. And then they turn around and use a totally new set of measurements or weights or standards when they'd sell it to people. In other words, they were cheating people when they were buying. They were cheating people when they were selling. It's all over the turf today. I mean, people are just lying, cheating, and stealing. It's just almost second nature. The deception and the lying, it's like people don't think anything of it. But, this, you know, in the book of Proverbs, it says that there are six things, actually seven, it says that the Lord hates. And one of them is a lying tongue. And that's become so proverbial today in our culture, where people just lie and don't think anything of it. But look at that verse 13. It says, So also I will make you sick, striking you down, desolating you because of your sins. Make you sick and strike you down. I'll give you an example. In other words, look at all the sexually transmitted diseases today. I mean, there's incurable herpes, there's gonorrhea, and there's HIV, and you know, the list goes on and on and on and on. And it's becoming epidemic. I mean, it is. It's epidemic. Well, what does God say? I will make you sick, striking you down, desolating you because of your sins. This is an example of what's happening in our society because we won't obey God. He says, you will eat, but you not be satisfied. In other words, you know, this country, even though we've got, we're the wealthiest nation on earth, we've got everything going for us, we also lead the world in divorce, in suicides, in drug addiction, and alcoholism, and, you know, all of these other things. So you can see that people aren't satisfied, right? And what you try to remove for safekeeping, he says, what will happen? It says, what you do preserve, I will give to the sword. And like I said, the government, you know, wields the sword. So look at what we're paying in taxes, in federal tax, state tax, local tax, property tax, sales tax, tax upon tax, excise tax, tax here, tax here. What are we paying? Over 50% of our income is going to taxes. I mean, we spend more on taxes than we do on food, shelter, and clothing. So that's a curse, right? And in verse 15, it says, you will sow, but you not reap. You will tread the olive, but you will not anoint yourself with oil, and your grapes, but you will not drink wine. In other words, you know, your labor will be in vain. And I can see that's happening more and more in this country. But it's one more curse that's being brought upon us because of our disobedience. But now look at this, what he says in verse 16. The statutes of Omri and all the works of the house of Ahab you are observed, and in them and in their devices you walk. Therefore I will give you up for destruction and your inhabitants for derision, and you will bear the reproach of my people. The statutes of Omri. Omri was one of the first kings of the northern tribes of Israel, and his son Ahab was, they were both notoriously wicked. Ahab married that notoriously wicked woman, Jezebel. Well, it's interesting. When you start throwing out God's laws, you throw out his commandments, right? And you throw out his ordinances and statutes. Look what Omri, the statutes of Omri and Ahab come up with. Omri and Ahab represent the state. They represent the government. So we throw out God's moral laws. The government steps in and makes up their own laws. Right. Give you an example. When God makes it abundantly clear, he says, hey, fornication is a sin. Fornication is premarital sex. Well, that's what God's law says. But we throw out that law. So now the state comes in and says, well, you can't give, you know, a 13-year-old girl an aspirin if she's at school without a parent's permission. But you could take her down and get an abortion. You can give her condoms. Is that the statutes of Omri or not? That's the statute of the states. I mean, I could go on all night, couldn't I? You could go on the list, the litany, could go on and on and on and on and on and on, couldn't it? Of how absurd and how asinine, how stupid, how ridiculous things are getting. Well, it says here that not only am I going to give you up for destruction, but it says here, your inhabitants for derision. Derision is what? You know, you're going to become a laughingstock. Look what happens when we do away with God's moral laws and we start putting in our own laws. And because we do away with God's moral laws, they've got to pass hundreds of thousands of laws. I'm not exaggerating. To try to keep people in check because there's, you know, they have this old massive undergrowth of laws and statutes and ordinances from Omri or the state because they're trying to keep people in line because they've thrown out the Ten Commandments.
Exactly.
See how stupid things are getting? Well, that's what Micah said. Now, does anybody have any questions? Okay, listen, we do have a half an hour. I would like to read this chapter 7 because that's what I intended on reading tonight because it's the last chapter and we got to finish up this book. Beginning with Micah chapter 7, verse 1. Woe is me, for I am like the fruit pickers and the grape gatherers. There is not a cluster of grapes to eat or a first ripe fig which I crave. The godly person has perished from the land, and there is no upright person among men. All of them lie in wait for bloodshed. Each of them hunts the other with a net. What he's saying here, woe is me, for I am like a fruit picker. In other words, Micah is speaking, but he's speaking on behalf of God. Basically saying, he's going to try to find some kind of fruit, and the fruit he's making the analogy about is trying to find an honest man. Trying to find a godly person, trying to find an upright, standing individual. It's like trying to find fruit that's worth eating, and you can't find any. And then he says that verse 2, the godly person has perished from the land. There is no upright person among men. All of them lie in wait for bloodshed. Each of them hunts the other with a net. I mean, you go ahead and read that, and you know, 99% of the people in this country are going to take offense because, hey, I'm basically a good person. That's what they're going to tell you, right? But, hey, they fall right into this category. It says here, all of them lie in wait for blood. How many people who are pro-abortion, pro-murder is what it is, how many people who are pro-abortion consider themselves to be quote-unquote good people? You won't find one of them, not one, who says, no, I'm not really a good person because I'm really a murderer or I sponsor murdering. I mean, people don't get it. It's hard for people to look at this because it's like looking in a mirror. But this is the way people are today. They think, wait, I'm a good person. I'm good. I'm upstanding. I'm decent. But, hey, get a clue. Take a good, hard, cold look at God's divine mirror, and you see how wretched you are. But this is so hard on human nature. People's hair stands up on their back when you say, hey, you are a sinner, and you're on the way to hell, and there's no good in you. Those are fighting words because people say, I'm good, I'm decent. But he says here, they all lie in wait for blood. Each of them hunts the other with a net, tries to exploit each other or takes advantage of each other or something of that nature. And he says, concerning evil, both hands do it well. I mean, this is this country, right?
Every Jefferson sin.
Right, and they're very, very skilled at it. And he says here, the princes are actually politician ass, also the judge for a bribe. I mean, this is where we're at. I mean, you can't get an honest man elected. They're going to say, well, what are you going to give me? That's why there's all these special interest groups. They're not out there to doing the best for the country. They're like, how are you going to grease my palms? Even these judges, these lawyers, I mean, it's incredible the kind of stuff that they will allow to go on in their courts for money. Just incredible. You just long for to have a person of integrity in these positions. He says, so they weave it together. The best of them are like a briar, the most upright like a thorn hedge. The day when you post a watchman, your punishment will come. Then their confusion will occur. Now, look at the way he describes these people. The best of them is like a briar, okay, full of thorns. The most upright is like a thorn hedge. Now, I'm reading that, and I guarantee you, Micah, when he talks about these people, these people's hair must have stood on edge. They became red-faced and indignation because they considered themselves good people. All you have to do is go back to the days of Jesus. Jesus referred to the scribes and the Pharisees and the Sadducees, the religious leaders of his days, as being whitewashed tombs, as being hypocrites, as being phony. He just lambasted them, right?
Yeah.
Well, these are the same people who felt like, hey, I am good. I am great. Me and God are in like this. I mean, I'm a religious leader. I'm special. I'm important. These people hated Christ. They hated him with a passion. They couldn't stand him because they were looking at righteousness incarnate and they could see their own wickedness and they just hated him. Hated him. This is what happens when a righteous man stands up and says, hey, what you're doing is wrong, man. You are hated. Because they look at themselves as being great or good or upstanding or godly. It says in verse 4, the best of them is like a briar, the most upright like a thorny hedge. The day when you post a watchman, your punishment will come. Then their confusion will occur. It says the day that you post a watchman. In other words, it's almost as though they post a watchman, of course, for the purpose of watching for an enemy or protecting themselves. Well, that's pretty significant because the day that they think that they are secure is when their punishment is going to come down on them like a ton of bricks. And Jesus said, like in the last days, he said, when they're crying peace and safety, sudden destruction will come upon them. And let's face it, we are really in the throes of the world is right teetering on the brink of destruction right now with everything that's going on in the Middle East. But the time isn't, it's not yet. But once everything happens to where things start falling in place and then people start saying, well, now there's going to be peace and safety. Then it's a kaboom. Look what he says after that. Verse 5. Do not trust in a neighbor. Do not have confidence in a friend. From her who lies in your bosom, guard your lips. For son treats his father contemptuously. Daughter rises up against her mother and daughter-in-law against her mother-in-law. A man's enemies are the men in his own household. Now, he's describing something here I think is very significant. Because when the punishment comes, when the chastisement comes, when the armies that God uses to come down on his people come, it's going to cause such stress and such strain on the nation that even in the families, they're going to be turning on one another. Like, look what happened when the Bolsheviks took over, the communists took over in Russia. everywhere they go, that they indoctrinate you, the state indoctrinates you to rat on your parents or rat on each other. But I'm telling you, when things get more and more stressful, people start turning on each other like animals. Look what he says here, because when things really start hitting, imagine yourself when the tribulation comes. Just think back when they had the oil embargo 20 years ago or more, right? And you had these long lines in the gas station. I mean, they were backed up for miles in some places. And then if somebody tried to cut in front, man, people would be pulling knives or guns or big fist fights because everybody's tense, right? And that was just because there was a gas shortage. Well, imagine if there's a food shortage. The kind of tension that's going to be generated, the kind of stress and the kind of animosity that's going to be going on. You see, this is a judgment, and it's going to come when the tribulation comes, tribulation period. I mean, people are going to be at each other's throats like you can't believe. And it's people that you would consider to be, you know, close to each other. This is a judgment for God. Why? Because we don't wrestle against flesh and blood, but against these spiritual forces of wickedness that are constantly pushing us, you know, at each other's throat. Read it again, because he says here, do not trust in a neighbor. Do not have confidence in a friend. From her who lies in your bosom, in other words, your own wife, guard your lips. For son treats his father contemptuously. Daughter rises up against her mother. Daughter-in-law against her mother-in-law. A man's enemies are the men of his own household. That's what happens when things get desperate. In other words, when God he warned his people in Deuteronomy and other portions, he said, if you don't obey me, one of the curses that's going to come upon you is there's going to be a famine. And he says it's going to get so severe, said some women who are so dainty they would never even, you know, stomp their foot on the ground in anger. He said they'd end up eating their own children and their own afterbirths and keeping it from their husbands. I mean, you talk about, you know, desperate times and how people's true nature will come out. I think it's very, very important, because up here he's describing these people. Look at the way he described it. The best of them is like a briar. The most upright, like a thorny hedge. The day when you post a watchman, your punishment will come on. In other words, he's describing these people as being wicked, but they don't see their wickedness. Mm-hmm. So God is going to have to allow them to be in a situation where their wickedness will come out, where they can see it, and everybody can see it. Mm. See what I'm saying? They'll be at each other's throat. They'll cut their own mother's throat for a nickel, for a slice of bread. You see what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. Hey, those are times you don't even want to be around. I mean, those are, you know, desperate times. But God's saying, okay, you don't get it. You don't see it. You won't listen to me. You don't believe that you are in need of repentance and reform. You don't. You think you're good. I'll show you what you're really like. Take away your comfort blanket and your true nature will come out. Wait till the tribulation comes. Then the distress will be so bad. When he says, a day's wage will buy a loaf of bread. I mean, then people's true nature will come out. Because people refuse to say, hey, in me is no good thing. Yeah.
So for clarification, this isn't referring to the true Christians. They can still talk to each other and...
Right. In other words, it's referring to people who are not living for God,
right,
but they're very religious people,
right,
at least in their own head. I mean, Jesus' day, there were very religious people, the scribes and the Sadducees and the Pharisees. They had such a delicate conscience that when Judas threw the 30 pieces of silver back in the sanctuary, he says, keep this damn blood money. These phonies picked up the money and said, well, this is blood money. You know, we really can't put this back in the temple. We need to buy a potter's field. Why? To ease their stinking conscience. I mean, you like to just slap them before their hypocrisy, right? It's like, we're so good. We're going to take this money and buy a potter's field to bury the stranger in, because we're so good. That they just murdered an innocent man. These same people who murder unborn children think, well, we're very good. So we're going to come up with another law that's called hate crimes. This is the type of mentality that's driving a fallen nature, okay? And so anyway, in verse 7 it says, but as for me, I will watch expectantly for the Lord. I will wait for the God of my salvation. My God will hear me. Now, you talked about the Christians here, okay? Micah is representative of God's true people, right? But as for me, I will watch expectantly for... In other words, I'm going to keep my eyes on the Lord. I'm going to wait for him. I'm going to look for him. I'm going to watch for him. And I will wait for the God of my salvation, you know, recognizing, hey, you know, he is the one that's going to save me. I can't save myself with my own phony righteousness. He says, my God will hear me Why? Because he's going to be right with God, because he believes God, and he's accepted God's evaluation of him, and he recognizes that he's the God of my salvation. I need to submit to him. He says in verse 8, "Do not rejoice over me, O my enemy. Though I fall, I will rise. Though I dwell in darkness, the Lord is a light for me. I will bear the indignation of the Lord because I have sinned against him. Until he pleads my case and executes justice for me, he will bring me out to the light, and I will see his righteousness." In other words, this is the redeemed Christian recognizing, hey, there's no good. I'm a sinner, and I need to be redeemed through the blood of Christ. At the same time, I need to be transformed through the chastisement of God to turn me into a new person. Okay? And then in verse 10, it says, "Then my enemy will see me, and shame will cover her who said to me, 'Where is the Lord your God?' My eyes will look on her, and at that time she will be trampled down like mire in the streets. It will be a day for building your walls. On that day, your boundary will be extended. It will be a day when they will come to you from Assyria and from the cities of Egypt and from Egypt even to the Euphrates, even from the sea to sea and mountain to mountain, and the earth will become desolate because of her inhabitants on account of the fruit of their deeds." In other words, he's talking about the end times. He's talking about how the people who look at Christians with contempt, they are going to be humiliated. They are going to recognize that, hey, yeah, the Christians were right on their stance on morality in regards to homosexuality and adultery and fornication. They were right in regards to their stand on abortion, in regards to their stand on all these things. Yeah, the Christians were right. And we, the media, and we, the secular world, we in the cultural elite, the college professors, all of these people who have just attacked and attacked and attacked and attacked these people are going to be humiliated in terms of when they see, mm-hmm. when they see that God is going to exalt those who are obedient to him and have followed him and obeyed him, and he's going to really humiliate those who, in their pride and their arrogance, thought themselves better than these other people. But he says here in verse 12, "It will be a day when they will come to you." Now he's talking about the millennial period. From Assyria. Now, Assyria is no longer in existence. The Assyrians are dead and gone from God's judgment. But the Assyrians represent God's enemies, the enemies of God's people. Mm-hmm. You know, there's Assyrians today, the spiritual Assyrians, are enemies of God's people. Mm-hmm. And the cities of Egypt, you know, sworn enemies of God's people. From Egypt, even to the Euphrates, even from sea to sea and mountain to mountain. In other words, all the people from everywhere in the world who have, you know, attack God's people are going to be humiliated and put to shame. And then he says, "And the earth will become desolate because of her inhabitants on account of the fruit of their deeds." In other words, he's jumping to where? He's jumping to that end of the world. The end of the world when it says the earth will become desolate because of her inhabitants on account of the fruit of the deeds. We are told in Isaiah very plainly that God is going to make man scarcer than gold, scarcer than the pure gold of Ophrah, because of man's wickedness. And then he says in verse, and then to change everything around, he concludes by saying in verse 14, "Shepherd thy people with thy scepter, the flock of thy possession, which dwell by itself in the woodlands in the midst of the fruitful field. Let them feed in Bashan and Gilead as in the days of old, as in the days when you came out of the land of Egypt. I will show you miracles. Nation will see and be ashamed. All of their might, they will put their hand on their mouth, and their ears will be deaf. They will lick the dust like a serpent, like reptiles of the earth. They will come trembling out of their fortresses to the Lord your God. They will come in dread, and they will be afraid before thee." In other words, what he's saying that, okay, in verse 14, he's saying, "Shepherd thy people with thy scepter." In other words, he's really talking to Christ. He is going to come back and shepherd his own people like a shepherd. And he's going to take possession of his people, both the Jews and the Gentiles who are committed to him. And they're going to, it says they're going to be in the midst of a fruitful field, and they will feed in Bashan and Gilead as in the days of old. In other words, when Christ sets up his millennial kingdom, okay, the whole world is going to be extremely fruitful and fertile. And people, there's not going to be any, you know, starvation or hunger or malnutrition or people suffering social and economically and all these other things. He's going to shepherd his people. But look what he says about the enemies. beginning with verse 15. As in the days of old when you came out of the land of Egypt, I will show you miracles. Nation will see and be ashamed. Look what's happening in Israel today. They are so hated. People, this hate is a demonic hate. This hate is an infernal malice that is bred in the bowels of hell. People don't see it. How could people be so blind, so hateful, so full of contempt that they're willing to blow themselves up, willing to send their children to blow themselves up to kill people they hate? But look what's going to happen. Nations will see and be ashamed of all their might. In other words, they're so proud of all of their, you know, military weapons that they think it's going to give them victory, but they're going to be ashamed of it in that day, and they will put their hand on their mouth, and their ears will be deaf. In other words, put their hand on their mouth. You would just like these people to shut up. Just shut up. And I'm talking about not just the people in the Middle East. I'm talking about these people over here, especially on our college campuses and in the media. And I just shut up because they're not telling you the truth. They're putting their spin. They're putting their lies. It's all demonic. It says here, their ears will be deaf. In other words, it's not going to be a day when they want to hear all these lies. They're going to plug up their own ears because don't tell me any more lies because I don't want any part of this. That's going to be there. But look what happens. Verse 17. They will lick the dust like a serpent. In other words, God is going to humiliate them. They're going to be crawling on all fours like reptiles of the earth. They will come trembling out of their fortresses. This is when Christ returns with great power in the sky. Every eye is going to see him. The ones that survive the tribulation period who have not gotten right with him, they're going to see him in great power, great glory, coming back, and they're going to turn to the mountains and the hills and say, hey, fall on us. Just crush us into oblivion. Hide us from the face of him who sits upon the throne and him, the wrath of the Lamb. They're going to be so terrified. But what's going to happen when Christ comes back? He's going to go right to Jerusalem, and he's going to send out his angels all over the world. And these people, they're hiding in caves, and they're hiding in fortresses, and they're hiding hoping that they won't be found out. Angels are going to be right there and say, hey, come here. You got an appointment.
Fine appointment.
You know?
And say what happened to evolution.
Yeah, right. You got an appointment there. And these angels, millions of them, are going to be carrying the righteous and the unrighteous to Jerusalem. What's left of them. What's left of mankind. And then, when they get to Jerusalem, Christ is going to separate them like sheep from the goats. He said, hey, I was hungry, I was thirsty, I was sick, I was naked in his prison. What did you do for me? Nothing. You know? And then the other group is, I was hungry, I was thirsty, I was sick, I was naked, I was in prison, and so on and so forth. And you did all these things for me. And they're all, both groups are going, when did we see you?
Yeah.
He says, hey, what you do to the least to my brother, you did it to me. And then the ones on the left, he's going to say, hey, depart from me, you practices of iniquity, into the everlasting fires of hell prepared for the devil and his angels. I mean, that's going to be a terrible time. And that's not the day of judgment. That's not the great white throne judgment. That's just the judgment that's going to happen after Christ comes back to set up his millennial kingdom. Okay, so what's going to happen to him? Look at it says in that verse 17. They will come trembling out of their fortresses when the angels start carrying them to Jerusalem. Okay, to the Lord our God, they will come in dread. You know, they don't want to go, but they're being carried. Probably kicking and screaming by their, you know, carrying by their collar. It says, and they will be afraid before thee. These are the same people who are so arrogant, who are so self-righteous, who are so contemptuous for God and the things of God. And it says in verse 18, who is a God like thee who pardons iniquity and passes over the rebellious acts of the remnant of his possession, which is his people? But the important word there says, who is a God like thee who pardons iniquity? How does he pardon iniquity? It says here, and passes over rebellious acts of the remnant of his. How did he pass over? Did he wink at it? Remember, that's where you get the word Passover, is when you took the blood of the lamb and you put it on the doorpost of the door and on a lintel of the door, and the destroying angel passed over when he saw the blood. That's how. Then when they ask here, who is a God like thee who pardons iniquity? It's the same God who died on the cross in order to pardon our iniquity, to pass over our rebellious acts. But the blood is what's all important there, and it's what's implied in this verse. He does not retain his anger forever because he delights in unchanging love. And he did it for love. You know, he came down and died in man's place for love, out of love for man. And then in verse 19, he will again have compassion on us. He will tread our iniquities underfoot. Yes, thou wilt cast all their sins into the depths of the sea. You know, for those people who have been passed over. It's not like, well, these wink, wink, nod, nod. You know, I know you're a wicked person, but, you know, since you're my favorite pet, you can come into heaven. No. It's like, hey, they've been passed over because they've been under the blood. Therefore, because they're under the blood, he takes their sins and he casts them into the deep depths of the sea. He casts them as far away from as east is from the west. And then he says in verse 20, last verse, it says, thou wilt give truth to Jacob and unchanging love to Abraham, which thou dost swear to our forefathers from the days of old. And then, in other words, when he sets up his millennial kingdom, he himself, Jesus Christ, can be reigning and ruling from Jerusalem and doing what? He will give truth to Jacob, give truth to his people. Okay, and unchanging love to Abraham's people. He will ruin. So, exactly 8:30. Does anybody have any question on that?